As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello everyone, and welcome once again to The View from the Lane. You know it's multi-award winning and it's the Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. And joining me, your host Danny Kelly, are The Athletic's Charlie Eccleshare and Jack Pitt-Brook. I don't even have time to say hello to the people today because we've got so much to get through. On today's episode, we'll discuss a draw at West Ham, the five-year anniversary of the new stadium, the financial results that have come out, deep in which is buried the news that Spurs are looking for outside investment to the club. Let's start with the 1-1 draw at the London Stadium. Charlie, you were there for The Athletic. Your match piece focused on the frustration around Maddison and his, not a great evening for him. There was much to say about the game. First of all, I think I saw you commenting that you were about 200 metres away from the action. So I probably had a better view of the game watching it on the TV, yeah?
You probably did. I mean, I do. I find... Yeah, where the press seats are there, I think is further away than any other stadium. And to me, it feels a bit like having a seat at a big gig in a stadium, whereby there's this sensation that you're kind of watching other people watching something. That's how I always feel if I'm sat at a big stadium gig. I really don't like doing it. And this feels like that. You just feel so detached from the action. You're so far away. You don't really feel a part of it. You feel far more like an observer than a participant, even though obviously you're not a participant wherever you're sat, but you can feel part of the game. Certainly at Spurs, you're a lot closer. I mean, it was pretty flat, I'd say, sort of entertainment-wise in as a whole. I can't think of many games under Postecoglou this season that kind of felt less energising. I mean, I guess there was the kind of mad flurry at the end where both teams were going end-to-end to try and find a winner, but there was a whole lot of nothing in there, I thought. I was struggling to think of a game that was less entertaining this season for Spurs.
I mean, there were reasons for that. West Ham defended extraordinarily deep. I mean, really, really on the edge of their penalty spot, I guess you would say.
And I should say saying that Spurs are there to just be entertaining. You know, that's not going to happen every game. It was just quite striking because generally one way or another, they have been. And yeah, I thought, West Ham, I guess, did a good job in largely frustrating them.
In a front three of Werner, Son and Johnson, I can't remember a quicker Spurs forward line. Bale, Aaron Lennon and somebody else would have to be very, very quick to make up that trio. And the point I'm making is, in the team also includes Van de Ven and Udogie. Why did Spurs play so slowly? I mean, they played at walking pace for the last hour of the game. They were brilliant for the first 15 minutes because they moved the ball quickly. Now, West Ham are allowed to react to that, and they did. They shifted to the midfield slightly to the right, and they retreated even further. But Spurs played, and recently it's become the thing, they played very slowly.
Though being rapid doesn't necessarily mean you've got quick feet or quick thought. And I thought that was...
But standing around with the ball at your feet does allow the other team to get themselves into very, very good defensive positions.
Yeah, but I mean, that's where all that, you know, all of that pace is less useful against low blocks than it is against teams that push out. I think what's frustrating, though, is that they did get the lead. So you would have thought that might have pushed West Ham onto them. And probably very briefly it did. And I remember there was one moment where Werner got it, I think when it was still 1-0, and kind of turned back, didn't really take his man on. I do think Richarlison playing through the middle and Son left is generally when Spurs have looked at their best this season. Save maybe for a couple of games early on when Richarlison moved out the team. But I just think that's where they have the better balance. I really like all that speed and that pace. I think it's, you know, there's a real place for it. It's really useful. But there are times, especially in away games, where Son can get a little bit swallowed up playing through the middle. I'm not saying he can't do it or he's bad at it. I just think there are some games where they do, where, you know, Richarlison's really useful. And I tweeted at the time saying, I think it was after about 75 minutes, I couldn't believe Richarlison hadn't come on to the extent where I thought he must just, you know, still not be fully fit, because it felt like such the obvious change to make was to put Richarlison on, move Son to the left. A few minutes later, they did eventually do it. I mean, you know, we talked about, you know, after the last game, I wrote about, and you and James talked about the fact that Kulusevski isn't in his best form and that maybe things look a bit slow in one respect with him. Obviously, he then came out of the team. Very rare that happened. Only the second time this season, when fit, he hasn't started in the league for Spurs.
And I wouldn't blame him for not making an impact, because the fella played three positions in 20 minutes, didn't he? The game was moving around him.
That didn't stop people. He seems to be the kind of villain du jour amongst a section of the Spurs fan base anyway, which I think is really unfair. I don't think he's clearly not in his best form, but, you know, that can happen, and he's not the only one. And yes, I mean, I wrote on Maddison, who second game running came off with 20 minutes plus stoppage time to go. I asked Postecoglou if he was carrying a knock. He said no. So it's a bit odd. And, you know, all his numbers are down, as the eye test would tell you, he started 9 games now since coming back from injury. He started 11 before the injury, so it's a pretty fair split. And, you know, and obviously these are ratioed per 90 minutes and everything's down. I just felt a bit for him. Like, he looked really frustrated for a lot of the night. He gets fouled so much. Like, he's the fourth most fouled player in the Premier League and he's missed a third of the season. It's incredible. And Paquetá did what Palhinha did to him a couple of weeks ago. He was just kicking him. And I did think that wasn't ref brilliantly, because Paquetá was basically emboldened to just keep fouling him. And then that one that led to the Antonio chance in the second half, he completely cleans him out in what would have been a really dangerous position for Spurs.
Well, but I'm presuming that VAR would have gone right back to that and stopped and disallowed Antonio's goal. Do you share my confidence?
Absolutely not.
Look, there's plenty of positives I want to talk about. First of all, the goal was brilliant. The ball was passed through 6 or 7 pairs of Spurs feet at pace. That allowed Werner to isolate against Soufal, who we know can be taken on the outside, and it was crossed in for Johnson to score. That was great. The goal we conceded, let me just say again, am I right? Have I got this wrong? It was a combination of Spurs' two weaknesses. A pass that went astray in a move on the edge of their box, exactly like the goal we conceded 4 days ago. The move goes up the right-hand side, exactly like 4 days ago, ends up in a corner, and then we have the issue of the goalkeeper being surrounded by, how can I put it, attendants. It was just painful, wasn't it? Just painful.
Yeah, and I was thinking that whole big talking point about Spurs not being able to defend set pieces that was such a thing in that Everton game. In
January, yeah.
Yeah, and then Wolves scored a couple of weeks later, but actually the previous few games felt like they'd been maybe a little bit better, or it's certainly been, they hadn't been exposed by it so much. And then, yeah, this was really bad. And there was one in the second half as well that Mavropanos really should have scored from. And just generally, they've kept 2 clean sheets in 21 league matches. People have different views on how important that is. Obviously, Spurs like to attack as well. They score loads of goals. They score pretty much they have scored in every game, but one of those 21 games. But it's not great, and it does just mean it's that bit harder to win games. And I think that was a particularly frustrating goal, because they had got the early goal for once. But after 12 straight goals in the second half of the game, they finally had a first half one. I think it was their first in 7 games. but they couldn't really kick on from it. And, you know, it's just frustrating when you're, when it's that easy to score against you. All it took was, you know, admittedly a good corner, and then one of their most dangerous players in set pieces is just completely free to back one in.
Jack, all of this adds up to this. This season, Spurs, and we still have a significant amount of the season to go, are the first team in over a decade to gain 20 points from losing positions and to lose 20 points from winning positions. At least we've got that excitement back into our football compared to what, you know, I was moaning about, and so I'm not moaning about it at all. You might call it inconsistency, you might call it drama.
Yeah, I think this is the most interesting thing about how Tottenham play. The more I think about what makes Ange Ball distinct, and I think it's this. So he said in a press conference the other day, you know, we don't want it to be influenced by the clock, we don't want it to be influenced by the scoreboard. And this, I think, is why, you know, this is why, let's say Tottenham are 1-0 up in a game where you would normally expect a team to take a step back and sit on it and try and control the game and see it out. Tottenham won't do that. They'll continue to play, even though that means there's a risk they concede an equaliser and fail to win the game. And I think that kind of explains, and Ange is pretty relaxed about this, I think. So it means that he doesn't mind that they often go 1-0 down in the first half. He's relaxed about the fact that often they don't break through the opposition until the second half or until later on. They've had lots of these turnaround wins. I think this is what marks them out as being so different from other teams, because even, I mean, a lot of the basis of how they play, like the tactical principles, defending high up the pitch, pressing high, dominating possession, inverting the fullbacks, a lot of this stuff, like other teams do it, I think, but I don't see other teams having this sense of we play how we play at all times under all circumstances. That, I think, is the interesting thing about Ange Ball.
And that is only going to get, you'd think that will only become stronger over time, because that's such a hard thing to essentially rewire players' brains. Because do you remember there was that friendly against Shakhtar and he went mad at them at half time because they were basically playing for half time from about 40th minute or something. And clearly it wasn't, he hadn't yet indoctrinated them into this way of thinking. And also, you know, there's clearly a lot to be said for that approach. We've seen them turn around a lot of leads. And you look at it, you know, they were playing West Ham yesterday, and West Ham in their previous game took off a striker for a defensive midfielder, surrendered the initiative, went from 3-1 up to 4-3 down. So, you know, when it works, it's great. And it, you know, that leading change hands, those numbers, Danny, that you say, they do make for great entertainment.
One or two questions about the game, which, you know, you're right, Charlie, it's almost best consigned to the dustbin of memory. And Spurs' record at London Stadium is not great, so that point might seem very valuable. Carpe Diem asked us on Twitter, X if you must, why can we not take a shot from outside the box? We always want to walk it in. It's driving me mad. And there were times yesterday when they did look like the worst of Arsene Wenger's teams, didn't they? Trying to make 70 passes where 17 would do and 7 would probably be ideal.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is part of a wider trend, isn't it, where teams are shooting less, and there's this kind of... brings out some of the culture wars over...
Stats ruining our game, Charlie. Back in my day, players used to shoot. As soon as they got the ball, they'd shoot as far out as possible. And now, I'm afraid the woke mob have convinced them not to shoot anymore. It's terrible.
Exactly.
They're padding their possession stats, Jack. That's all it's about.
I saw an interesting thread about John McKenzie, who works for TIFO, part of The Athletic, was saying how... having watched a lot of football from this kind of supposed golden era of people taking loads of shots, it was more about the fact that now teams are so much better at attacking. They can work better shooting positions, so there's less need to kind of take speculative 25, 30-yard shots. Look, let's not dismiss it, because there is something in it, and I think there's certainly some fans find it frustrating with a player like Maddison, who they would have seen... certainly on highlights reels, scoring long-range goals for Leicester, and we don't see that. I can only surmise that it does come down to the fact that it's really hard to work properly good shooting positions from range against a team that defends as diligently as West Ham. And players are aware that doing so, you know, the chances of scoring are really, really, really remote, and you're just booting away possession. And some might not like that. Some might think, fuck the numbers, just have a go. but eschewing that approach often leads to goals. You know, you look at a lot of Spurs' goals come from intricate 1-2s. They work space to the byline, and from there you've got such a better chance than just swinging in a cross or having a hopeful shot. So I think that's the logic, even if it could be frustrating at times to watch.
Jack, let's move on then to what was a landmark, if not a very not a great night for Son Heung-min, but his 400th appearance for Spurs. Now, that it takes some doing in the whole long, nearly a century and a half of Spurs now. Only, I think, 15 players have made that number of appearances. He is a Spurs great. I know you're going to write about this, Charlie, but I'm getting Jack's view on this first. He is a Spurs great, that's for sure. How far is he off from being a Premier League legend? Because, I mean, everything he's done, you know, he's won the Puskas Award. He's won the Golden Boot. He's done all kinds of extraordinary things. He scores 10 or more goals every season. He's an incredible footballer.
He's obviously one of Tottenham's greatest players ever, I think, certainly in the modern era. I think he's probably one of the greatest... I think he is one of the greatest players in the modern era of the Premier League, even though it's kind of difficult to judge these things when you're right in the moment. And I think maybe it will take the perspective of time to have a better sense of Son and where Son stands. But certainly, if you look at, let's say, the last 10 years, the best players in Premier League of the last 10 years have very obviously been Salah. This is not in order. It's just Salah, De Bruyne, Kane. Salah, De Bruyne, Kane and Son, I think, have been more or less the four best players in the last few years. And obviously, Haaland's emerged. Mane was very good and has now left. Firmino was good and has now left. The Arsenal players, I think, are slightly younger, so I think it might be a little bit too early to judge some of those guys.
Eden Hazard had 3 years where he was just incredible to watch.
Hazard was one of those players. In my mind, I bracket Hazard at almost like a Bale or a Van Persie or a Suarez, someone who was brilliant for a narrow period of time, rather than having that. Whereas like Kane, De Bruyne, Salah, Son have been brilliant for a longer period of time than those guys who had kind of shorter peaks.
I mean, the numbers back that up, because since Son arrived, he has the third most goal contributions, so total goals and assists. Kane top, Salah second, Son third, De Bruyne fourth. And obviously, Salah didn't play all of those seasons, nor has Kane now. He hasn't played this one. Did De Bruyne? Yeah, De Bruyne was 15-16 as well. He joined in 15.
He's had quite a few injuries along the way.
Yeah, so he joined the same time as Son. So yeah, possibly some fewer appearances. But even that, you know, speaks to Son's longevity. He's been such a big Premier League player for such a long time.
I think the really interesting thing about Son that I was thinking about this yesterday, like, because I've seen a lot of Spurs fans saying things along the lines of, I actually prefer Son to Kane, or I'll be sadder when Son leaves than I was when Kane left, that kind of thing. And so I've been trying to get my head around why is it that some people love Son even more than they love Kane? Because obviously Kane has scored more goals for Spurs, and it would be a surprise if Son ever matches the numbers that Kane has put up. And I think one of the amazing things to me about Son is that he's never really been controversial. Like, he's never really felt contested. Like, with Kane, there was always, you know, there was always arguments about, you know, was he actually... Was he going to have a bad second season? Was he bad
one
in
trick
August?
Pony.
Was he
yeah, yeah.
was he a one trick pony? All that kind of stuff. Whereas with Son, he's been so obviously really good and so consistent. And I know he was bad last season. I also think another thing that's really played into Son's benefit is the fact that there has, quite remarkably, never ever been any speculation about the chance of him leaving. And I think that's kind of bizarre for many reasons, because he is obviously one of the best players. He has been one of the best players in the world over the time of his being at Spurs. But there's never been any talk about him leaving. As far as I know, no club has really made a big push to try and get him, although there has, you know, of course, there's always been interest. And so I think that has made his position as a Tottenham player kind of uncontroversial or uncontested. And so there's never been any kind of narrative of Son needs to leave to win trophies.
I definitely agree with Jack that no transfer saga or anything like that has made a big difference. I mean, if you think that Kane, for his last 2 years at the club, it was always known that, you know, he wanted to leave the club. quite forcefully. And maybe as well, and this is intangible, but is there a certain coldness to Kane, possibly? Like, he's quite clinical. He doesn't... Whereas Son, there's such a warmth, there's such a... I don't know, like, you know, it's always thing of like everyone at the club loves Son. Kane, obviously incredibly diligent, incredibly dedicated, incredibly committed. I don't feel maybe there was that same level of warmth from him and therefore perhaps to him. It kind of in the round anyway, obviously there would have been from a lot of people.
I feel like Son plays with his heart on his sleeve a lot more than Kane does. I feel like Son's often been the kind of emotional heartbeat of the team. And when they win, he's so up and he's so happy. And when they lose, he looks really upset. And obviously, whereas with Kane, I just feel like Kane doesn't really have that same. I think that kind of like almost like dead-eyed consistency that he puts in every day, and like regardless of the external circumstances or anything else, that is a huge part of what makes Harry Kane a great player. But he doesn't quite have that kind of. That same kind of obvious emotional energy, I think, that Son has. I don't think, and so I think they're fundamentally different people.
Personally, I love him because he never causes any trouble and because he's a wonderful footballer, which goes a long, long way with me.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, it's 5 years since the new stadium opened. Jack and Charlie have worked on two special pieces available to read in The Athletic on that fifth anniversary of the new stadium, which is actually, as we speak, today. Let's talk about the building of the stadium itself. I think, Charlie, you took the lead on that. It was an amazing thing they set out to do, and to do it was fantastic.
Yeah, I do, having spoken to people involved in the process and at the club at the time and what have you, it just sounds like the most phenomenally stressful, draining, demanding, exhausting, ultimately satisfying experience. But I think it left a really big legacy. You know, we didn't want that first piece to be a kind of blow-by-blow account of the build, because I think that's kind of been well documented. What was more interesting to me was what it was like being part of that, and then what it was then like, the fact that it's not like, you know, okay, the stadium build, right, that's done, we can wash your hands and, you know, it will now run itself. Then you've got such a big task actually making, you know, building the stadium and getting it ready was one thing, you know, and that took ages. And obviously there were delays, additional costs, as there were, you know, often are in these sort of things. But then there's, how do we make a success of it? Be that commercially, how do we make it work for the fans, et cetera, et cetera? Do the players like it? And I think a lot of people were really drained afterwards. And I think what's really interesting about it is then, you know, everything does kind of come back to that stadium. It's changed the club so fundamentally, and this challenge they have in retaining who they were, but also becoming a modern club and bringing in the necessary revenues and all of that. So how do you evolve while retaining the thing that it was that made Spurs unique and different and entrepreneurial and a bit quirky and all of these sorts of things? And actually, it's funny, like, when we were initially talking about this anniversary, we talked with James about doing kind of five pieces, so kind of a, you know, a whole week of pieces. We eventually did two, but we had more than enough material to do five, probably 10. I mean, it was just thousands of words of interviews and notes and research and what have you, because both in the lead up and then subsequently, so much of Monday Spurs comes back to that stadium build.
You know, we'll come on to what it's meant for the club in other ways. I remember as they were getting to finish it and we were still playing away from there, I was driving around with my now wife in North London. And, you know, she's an Arsenal fan. She was driving the car and she turned to me and she said, "Do you want to go and look at it then? Because we could see it on the right." I said, "Sure." And it was one of those days when the workers were still doing this and that and the other. And we pulled up on a piece of ground. It wasn't a forecourt where they were still working. And I got out of the car and walked around. When I came back, she said, "Have you been crying?" And I said, "Yeah, I have." I was in tears. The size of the thing, the extraordinary beauty of the outside of it matching the sky, which I could see was what was starting to happen. And when, of course, when you're inside it, and I don't get to go as often as I would like, it is just an incredible thing in and of itself. It matters, though, that it actually benefits the club and the fans in the long run. But yes, it caused me to cry. The outside of it made me weep with bewilderment, wonderment, actually, I suppose is the word I'm looking for when they were doing it. It's there, Jack. Everyone acknowledges it's a wonderful thing. The American football hasn't quite arrived yet full time, but what you've written a piece about what it's all meant and how they've used it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was just trying to get into this sense of what does it actually mean for the football club? Because, I mean, on first glance, you could say the football team is not any better now than it was in the old White Hart Lane. And, you know, since they've moved, they've had what, not including the 18-19 season where they played, what, 90% of it at Wembley, but they've had, what, one fourth-place finish in a season that was played fully at the new stadium. They might well come fourth this year. They've reached, what, one... Well, I mean, if you could count the 2019 Champions League final, but again, that was a sort of split season. They've reached one cup final, behind closed door, or almost entirely behind closed doors, 2021 League Cup final. So I don't think the team's any better, really, but we can come on to that. But I think what is most important is that the stadium transforms the kind of global reach of the club in a few ways. One is just in terms of visibility, I think, in terms of, like, you know, this is, they no longer have a sort of typical Victorian era, a slightly rickety square-sided stadium. They now have a stadium which I think is probably the best in the UK, maybe even the best in Europe. But also, more importantly, it's a stadium that makes them a huge amount of money. Accounts have come out today for last season, match receipts of £117.6 million for last season, which is up from £106 million the previous season. So they make, I think, just under £6 million per home game with, you know, obviously tickets, food and drink. The whole stadium is a kind of a gigantic ATM, basically, for the club, because it makes so much money on match days. It makes so much money on non-match days. You know, Beyonce, boxing, go-karting now, NFL, rugby union. There's so much. They always have stuff on. And that means that the revenues for the club are far, 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 far higher than they would have been in the old stadium. And given that it now looks like we live in an era where teams will stand or fall by their revenues, that is an era in which PSR is going to be enforced, and therefore you can't just rely on, you know, another handout from daddy, which is basically how football's worked for the last 20 or 30 years in the UK. That's great news for Tottenham, because it means that, because they do have this guaranteed revenue stream all the time. You know, they smashed through the £500 million barrier for the first time in terms of revenues. No wonder they're such big supporters of PSR, because in the era of PSR, having a stadium that brings in this much money is the goose that keeps laying the golden egg.
What do they have to do? This is a huge question. We haven't got a great amount of time to translate that revenue generating power into an improvement on the pitch, which you rightly pointed out is much more hard to see.
Well, I think they have spent more money on players. Like, you know, obviously the stadium stopped them from spending money on players before it opened, you know, 6-7 years ago. But I think in the last few years, they have bought a higher level of player, the kind of deals they wouldn't have done in the past. So, just in the last few years, you can look at Maddison last summer, Romero, obviously in 2022, they turned him permanent, Porro the previous January. You know, these are all 40-plus million-pound players. So they are... Richarlison was, what, £50 million?
Plus add-ons, yeah.
Yeah, so they are spending more money, not just on kind of prospects. You know, they're spending big money on established players. I think the other thing that you need to do, of course, is appoint the right manager, which they have completely failed to do. And I actually think the stadium made them appoint the wrong manager, because the stadium convinced them. They said, like, we're a big club, we've got the best stadium, let's do what a big club would do and appoint a famous manager. And it didn't work, and they did it again. It didn't work the second time either.
That's a thread that came through in conversations we had, and I think that is really interesting. And that's what I mean about it being more than just a stadium. It was a symbol of we're one of the big boys now, and the big boys appoint Jose Mourinho and Antonio Conte.
I think that's another really interesting thing, which is the way in which... This is something Charlie and I have been talking about. The way in which having the stadium changes your sense of what Tottenham Hotspur is, because it's kind of gone from being just a football team to being a football team that owns one of London's premier sports and entertainment venues, and as well as organising a football team, also puts on all these like cool events at the stadium. But also, does it change the kind of ethos of the whole thing? How do you retain that kind of distinct, I hate to use the word Spursy, but that distinct kind of Spursiness, if you know what I mean?
Well, you'd prefer Spursy to being a reflection of something corporate, wouldn't you?
That's the challenge, isn't it? Is how do you retain the ethos and values of the club? And obviously, you know, everyone who listens to this podcast will know what I mean, but like the things that make Tottenham Hotspur Tottenham Hotspur, how do you do that while also being a kind of giant of the modern global sporting landscape with your £500 million a year revenue, your Beyonce concerts, your NFL, your kind of tours of the US, tours of Asia, or everything that goes with being like
Australia,
one of the biggest sports brands
post-season
in the world.
Friendly.
Yeah, it's a really difficult balance, isn't it, Charlie?
Yeah, and I think that such a big part of this does come down to results on the pitch. Like that is the prism through which ultimately so much of this is viewed. And, you know, I think, you know, like Spurs announcing a go-karting track, they did that last season at a time where the football was awful. I think it was around the time they went out of the Champions League or about to go out of the Champions League. It was like, you know, all of that stuff. And obviously an announcement like that at that time gets the, what are we doing? If you're doing well, either no one cares or they think, ah, cool, yeah. It's kind of nice that we're doing extra stuff. Maybe that's why our finances are in good shape and, you know, we can go out and buy good players and things like that. And maybe, you know, that is kind of a lesson in all of this. You know, the way the stadium is viewed, I do think it's hard for a lot of people to view the first 5 years as a massive success, because numbers and what have you leave them feeling pretty cold. You know, people who are actually supporters of the club. Because that they're not going to remember that. All they're going to remember from the last 5 years really is the dark days under Conte and Mourinho and Nuno being there. We shouldn't mischaracterize it. There have been some great nights within that. Obviously, really early on, those Champions League nights or under Conte beating Arsenal 3-0 to get top four. But, you know, this season, it's really the stadium, I think, has come alive. And, you know, post-game, the mood in the stadium, the music, Postecoglou calling it a nightclub. I mean, that was when it really, that more than anything else, you know, those early wins in that part of the first part of the season when it felt like kind of anything was possible, that's what really elevated the stadium. But clearly, you know, it's there. It provides this huge platform and this huge opportunity for them to kick on if they can get those big decisions on the footballing side right, which they just haven't the last 5 years.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/theathletic.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Which takes us to another thing then that's happened, and both of you, I suspect, haven't had a chance to go into the depths of this because it's only just come out. The club have announced their financial report. There's also a slightly interesting mystery investment thing in it. And as you say, Jack, you've already introduced this. I mean, huge numbers now, and it looks, when you see, compare it to what Leicester announced yesterday, it looks all incredibly healthy.
The headline figure is, I think, the overall revenue smashing through the £500 million a year mark, matchday revenue going up to £117 million a year. I still think that's just behind Manchester United, makes it the second most in the league. I think the most interesting thing here, which something that Charlie and I have written on briefly this morning, is this section towards the very bottom, which says, quote, "To capitalise on our long-term potential, to continue to invest in the teams and undertake future capital projects, the club requires a significant increase in its equity base. The board and its advisors, Rothschild & Co., are in discussions with prospective investors. Any recommended investment proposal would require the support of the club's shareholders." So this is very interesting for quite a few reasons. But I think the first thing is that Tottenham are telling the world that they're in talks about selling a stake in the club. Tottenham have been in this. Somebody did say to me last week that there were talks ongoing about something like this. But there's, you know, there have been talks for years. You know, for years and years, all the background noise with Enoch has been: are Enoch going to sell? When are they going to sell? Who are they going to sell to? Are they up for sale? And there's always been arguments about whether or not it's true to say they're up for sale. I am just very interested that Tottenham put this out there this morning. I think it's
very surprised. Very surprising they did this.
Yeah, it's not the normal way they'd handle something, is it, Charlie?
No, exactly. Like getting, you know, this kind of revelation, I suppose you'd have to call it, you know, the way they did it is very rare. And as Jack says, because it's been an ongoing thing, the line has often just been, you know, we're always, I mean, Daniel Levy, I guess he said that, I think it was back in October, maybe September, to Bloomberg, you know, said that, you know, we, when there's interest, we have to listen, et cetera, et cetera. But the line has always been that, yeah, you know, this is just an ongoing process kind of thing. But yeah, this was very striking. This and the bonus, an increased salary that Daniel Levy's going to get, were the two things that jumped out. We should say as well, they've posted losses, 86.8 million losses as well, over this financial year. But yeah, revenues have gone up massively. But yeah, the thing I think has caught most people's eyes is Daniel Levy's salary going up and a $3 million bonus. And, you know, it didn't take long. I'm sure, Danny, you did the sums.
Yeah. I opened my eyes this morning, saw the figures, go, isn't that bonus, the $3 million, the exact amount the club is going to make from increasing the season ticket prices by 6%? I'm not a mathematician, but it's within 1% of being exactly the same. And people will quite rightly will say, hang on, what?
I mean, it brings to mind, do you remember in 2020, there was similar bonus and salary increase came just at the time of Spurs were furloughing staff. And I remember that day, you know, it was absolute bedlam. And now, obviously, those two things were even less connected because that was for a set of accounts, obviously, that way predated COVID and all of that. But these things, you know, these accounts have become a really big day in the Spurs calendar. And it's kind of a sign of the times. You know, fans are so engaged, so interested. And it is, and especially in the age of PSR, you know, this last week or so, you know, you mentioned Leicester there. This has become a really big topic in football, not just at Spurs, but far wider than that.
So much so that I actually think this podcast should appoint a financial expert.
What, rather than us just bullshitting about it? Nah.
Well, it has served us very well in the past, but I suspect that, as you say, me waking up and running a fine tooth comb over the figures may not be the exact examination.
But this is like a comparison with Spurs, isn't it? We'd then become too kind of corporate and we'd lose that entrepreneurial spirit that made us quirky if we start, you know, bringing in actual experts.
Yeah, we've done the serious stuff about accountancy and all the rest of it, which turns out we're all absolutely certified experts. Back to statues, plaques, and of course, in the case of the King of Norway, official portraits of Spurs players and fans. And Jack, you've been scouring the earth for further advances in this field. What have you found for us?
20th century philosopher A.J. Ayer was a big Tottenham fan. So A.J. Ayer, the don of logical positivism, is a big Tottenham fan. Apparently, he used to actually go to White Hart Lane in the old days. And this is not, like something that somebody invented to flog a t-shirt.
It's not John Cena, no.
It's not John Cena. He's actually a big Spurs fan. And while there is no, as far as I'm aware, no AJ Ayer statue, he does have a blue plaque. So there's a blue plaque near where he used to live in, like near Marylebone Station, put up by Westminster City Council. Lived here from 1980 to 1989, so the last 9 years of his life.
Well done, Jack. That was fantastic. Somebody has sent us a picture of, he's definitely a Spurs fan, so this definitely counts. And it is a statue. Ledley King, of course, these days an ambassador, fantastic player, captain of the club and all the rest of it, is immortalised in one of those stamped-out steel, two-dimensional sculptures in Mile End Park in Tower Hamlets, because it's part of the world where he's from. He is in rusty steel, with lots of bits cut out of him as well. It's clearly him. It is fantastic, but not as fantastic as the fact that he's alongside two other very deserving statues. He's alongside the suffragette Sylvia Pankhurst and a canal towpath horse. As you know, for most of Britain's history, the canal barges were not driven by motors, but pulled by horses. So one of these animals is represented with a cut-out steel statue, as is Sylvia Pankhurst, as is Lord Ledley King. And it's just a beautiful thing. But listen, whoever sent us that or whoever found that out, thank you very, very much indeed. And the quest continues for public recognition of Spurs players, fans, legends, etc. Listen, thank you very much, guys. It's been a difficult one to do because the match was boring and the accounts are just out. But thank you very much, Jack, and thank you very much, Charlie. Thank you all for listening as well. You know that we have an official home on Twitter at VFTL Podcast. You can email us at vftl@theathletic.com. And for the best Spurs coverage anywhere, Charlie, Jack, so many more excellent writers. Make sure you sign up to The Athletic itself. Till we meet again on next Monday, bless you all. Come on, you Spurs.
The Athletic.